So this is Roger Molina on Creative Disturbance, and I'm delighted here to be talking and arguing with Alan Algaronoff, and I'll let him present himself in a second. But I now describe myself as a recovering astronomer. I don't do any actively, but occasionally I drink some late at night, an earth science researcher, and an experimental editor and publisher. So Alan, who are you and what do you do in life?
I'm a doctoral student here at Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health in Boston, and also in a secondary field called critical media practice. And a lot of my research sort of, well, I guess we'll get to that today, but it hovers around questions of health itself, bureaucracy, civics, you name it.
Okay, so that's a very hybrid set of interests, public health and critical media. So what, you know, I think one of the things you've mentioned is this concept of the Mediterranean diet. You want to tell us about that a bit?
Yeah, well, in the late 1950s, early 1960s, there was this group of scientists under the name of the Seven Countries Study that wanted to link cardiovascular disease with diet and lifestyle. And today, their discovery is what we know as the Mediterranean diet, rich in nuts and olive oils and fish and whole grain produce.
You said these researchers wanted to link the Mediterranean diet to human health in some way. So what do you mean by the researchers wanted to link? Does that mean they were only looking for evidence that supported the hypothesis?
Interesting question. They noticed that more and more people were dying of heart disease, and they went out to try to understand why across seven different countries. And one of their focus areas happened to be diet and lifestyle. And while they were on these, while they were out in the field, they happened to immerse themselves in that very culture. And so they had come out saying that, oh, yes, this Mediterranean approach to living is really good for you. And it's really healthy and heart healthy in particular.
Okay, so let me just rebound on that. So what you've described is a technique in science, which is often a good idea. It's just they were embedded scientists. So they actually went to the culture they were studying and live there for a while, is that right?
Yeah, it's funny because today that is referred to as the romantic era of epidemiology. So this is when epidemiologists or people who run statistics on the distribution and determinant of disease, this is an era when people actually went into the field, and we call that the romantic era.
Okay, that's a new one to me. But then, you know, maybe it was there an implicit bias in their study that it was just so much fun to study people in Greece or Italy compared to, I don't know, the north of England or Canada, that, you know, they found what they were looking for, that a Mediterranean diet was much better than a North European diet.
Yeah, I mean, to some sense.
That's a romantic explanation.
Yeah, but you know, it's surprisingly probably the best approach to doing their research. I mean, yes, they may have engaged in sunbathing and smoking and eating fine foods and sexual encounters and movie making and making music, but I think all of that.
I tell you, you're making the Mediterranean diet sound so wonderful. but as you just convinced me, it's the context that matters, not just what you put in your mouth.
Right. I think the lead investigator of the study once said, the Mediterranean diet is so great, even if it wasn't healthy, it would still be good for you.
Well, I'll drink to that. It's only 4 o'clock here in Paris, so I can't have my first cocktail yet. But But let me just shift gears. So, so yes, the context of the Mediterranean diet, but what really, when was this work originally done?
Late 1950s, early 1960s, around that time.
Okay, so how solid is the evidence that, in fact, the Mediterranean diet has health impact?
It depends on who you ask. I mean, I think that there's definitely truth to it, but I think the definition of health is where most people get stuck. In public health, we ironically mostly study disease, not health self. So perhaps it prevents cardiovascular disease, but the Mediterranean diet, I think what these researchers were getting at goes a little bit more beyond just heart disease. I think there's something about health itself. There is something about human flourishing. There is something about happiness that perhaps has gotten a little swept under the rug in academia. And this dominant narrative of the biomedical nature of the diet has kind of taken over.
Okay. Before we go on to the topic of academic unhappiness, which might be the name of this podcast, before we go into that topic area, when in that same period of the 50s and 60s, my father, Frank Molina, knew Linus Pauling. And that was the time when, you know, Pauling was convinced that vitamin C was the miracle additive. And, you know, he tried to convince everybody just to take a very high dose of vitamin C and you'd never get the cold or the flu or I don't know what else. Well, you know, it's turned out the evidence is, yes, you should have a balanced diet, and a Mediterranean diet is balanced because fruits and vegetables do have vitamin C in them. But taking, you know, a huge dose of vitamin C every day, there's no evidence that for most people that has any benefit. So, you know, this idea that there's a magic pill to solve coronary heart disease, Mediterranean diet, a magic pill.
I mean, I think that it's become so. It's become that, you know, now there are organizations that are geared towards promoting this diet, and it links to tourism, of course, to countries like Italy and Greece. You know, there's definitely a business going on here that is trying to push this idea. And I think there is truth to it, but no, maybe you shouldn't drink a bottle of olive oil every day. I think what these researchers were trying to do was uncover something a bit bigger, but perhaps that message didn't come out. And that's sort of my mission today, is to try to understand what else was really going on in the field, and what is the Mediterranean diet really beyond just the diet like we think of diet, like food, but also diet like how you present yourself and behave, and
getting a month of paid vacation every year. Okay, before we go too deep in this direction, this whole issue of correlation is not necessarily causality. I mean, there's a deep one in science when you're dealing with things like human health. It is a complicated thing, but you referred to obstacles, and I know. You know, the comment you just made that these people retired there is almost critical media's angle of attack of why understanding why science is done and other science is not done. It's my understanding that you've had some internal battles to fight within Harvard to get your thesis project approved.
Oh yeah, I mean, I've experienced numerous obstacles to doing this research. Everything from something as basic as getting funding to getting access to site, to presenting it at conferences, to getting IRB approval. These have all been obstacles, and they've actually all turned into critical media projects, things like sculptures, videos, performances. And of course, ended up helping out with my dissertation in the end anyway. I could talk to you about a couple of them if you're interested.
Well, before you do that, you know, maybe without naming names of the incompetent people that have caused obstacles, you have a PhD committee in place?
I'm putting them together as we speak. I've been putting together a committee, rearranging them. Yeah.
Okay. And so what are the kinds of disciplines that the members of your committee will represent in some way?
Well, I mean, you asked about bureaucracy. I think at least two of them have to be related to public health. So this third person, unfortunately, has to represent 10 different disciplines. I'm not sure if that answers your question, but I think it gets at the office politics at the university where, you know, even if you're doing public health, that doesn't mean you can get a committee that's very diverse. It still has to be in that one discipline.
Yeah. Like a chemistry professor might be helpful, but you can only have one third member from outside your school. So, you know, and that is a very common obstacle, only in universities, where if you're in a given school, then your PhD committee has to be chaired by someone in that school. And you can have one outsider, but otherwise they only have to be people who are in that school. Well, that's a non-intellectual reason for picking someone on your PhD committee.
Right. And it's especially difficult if you're in a school that happens to be very homogenous. So in my school, most faculty tend to be epidemiologists. So all of them work with quantitative data. So if I have to choose two committee members, that usually means that I have to pick two epidemiologists.
So I just got an idea. So, you know, where I work in at UT Dallas with Oscar and a bunch of other people, you know, it's a typical university that has a school structure. And so indeed, if for undergraduate students, they do a senior project, and their senior project advisor must be in a school. Well, why? Isn't it the end of the project that matters, not who gets credit for advising the student? And so last year, we made a small donation to the university, and we set up the Marjorie Duckworth Fund. And once a year, we will give $500 to a student who managed to get advisors from more than one school on their committee. And maybe you'd be interested in being our first advisor to this project.
I'd be delighted.
Because, you know, it's easy enough for me to get students enrolled in my class from outside the school. But it takes a lot of work. I have to go up three levels in the bureaucracy because it's not a required or elective or whatever in the other school. And so, you know, the problem you're talking about of how someone doing an interdisciplinary thesis really needs advisors from very different backgrounds, the university makes it difficult for you to do that.
Right. Except, you know, at Harvard, one thing that has saved me is this critical media practice secondary field. And so what that means is I end up having kind of like two dissertations, one that is in the tradition of my school and then a capstone project that is allowed to be a bit more expressive. And so that's actually where most of my risky science is being conducted, is through things like video and sculpture and performance and other media, whereas some of my other research or the more mainstream stuff ends up being my dissertation. And it's a divide rather than sort of an integration, but I think it's like a step in the right direction at least.
And I would totally agree with you. And unfortunately, if you look at most universities where there are critical media department, the ethos or the culture of that critical media department is, oh, we criticize what's not good, but no, we don't help fix it. And so for you to both, what you just articulated, you're going to do a critical media approach, manifested in a different way than in public health, but you're also doing a to do a public health thesis where you take your critical media knowledge and use it in your public health research. And, you know, that is quite a gymnastics act for a lot of people. And so in the Leonardo organizations, we call these emerging Leonardos. And let me tell you, Da Vinci did not make a living doing what he wanted to do.
I mean, you know, good research is good research. And I think that that's something that I'm learning by having to sort of play both of these identities. I think that, you know, before I might have distinguished between art and science. Today, I think those two are more or less the same, at least not institutionally, but perhaps more so intellectually.
I'm going to contradict you. You know, the way I think this minute is, you know, here am I sitting in a room in France, talking to two people, trying to make sense of what we're all saying. Mm. It's getting kind of hot in the room I'm in. So I feel like stepping up and opening the window. I just ran out of coffee. So, you know, we are beings trying to make sense of our situation. And there are many ways of making sense of what's going on. You know, I do know that boiling water is dangerous, and therefore I do not pour it on myself except by mistake. So that's a practical reductionist knowledge, which a lot of science is. You know, if you want to have less health problems, then a Mediterranean diet is a good thing. And there is scientific evidence that is a good thing. But if you were sitting in the same room as me, you might think the temperature is wonderful. Each of us has grown up in a different temperature environment, and you know, feeling hot is different for different people. And so then you get into the subjective and, you know, phenomenology and all those other areas of knowledge. So there are many ways of knowing, many ways of making sense, and you need to combine them. So they're not the same thing, but drawing on different ways of knowing at a given time, you need to learn how to do that. So how do you like that contradiction?
Yeah, I mean, I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, I can reference like David Byrne, right, who said "Stop making sense," in that great album in the Talking Heads. I think that that is precisely what we need, is to sort of stop being so rational about some of the things that we're researching, and perhaps go off on a tangent every now and then, play around every now and then. In my work, that's in the form of green screen. It's in the form of, you know, sonic portraits and videos and sculptures and random shenanigans and autobiographical documentary film. I think that, you know, there does need to be some exploration, at least at the beginning stages of your dissertation, before you jump to any topic or conclusion.
Well, and you'd think, I mean, you stated something which I think to Oscar and I is just an obvious truth. And I don't know if you know the work of Robert Rube Bernstein, but he's done these longitudinal studies of successful scientists and engineers. If you compare the successful ones against the less successful ones, the less successful ones worked too much in the lab and didn't do enough thinking or activity, cognitive, embodied cognition outside the lab. And the fact that you were able to make an amazing sonic portrait or whatever you said in the process is not considered part of the research creativity. And
mention it briefly. I mean, what had happened is, yeah, I mean, so I couldn't gain access to the restaurant to do research.
No, I mean,
so
exactly.
I came in as an extra
sonic portrait
for a food
network,
just like a TV show, and that became the research itself. You know, why is it so difficult to access these spaces?
Okay, so we need to wrap up in a few minutes, Oscar. Alan and I just doing the usual academic nonsense talk. or does any of this resonate with your experience as a student at UT Dallas?
Oh, I'd say it certainly resonates with my experience as a student at UT Dallas, and probably for many students who might be listening to this podcast, that there's a certain level of bureaucracy and there are levels that you need to go through in academia, basically to get anything done. So I find that very relatable.
Okay. One of the ideas you had that you and Kristen Dupree are working on, maybe you can tell us the idea you had.
Well, we're right now what I'm working on with another member of the lab, Kristen Dupree, creating art pieces out of recordings of animal communication. So really taking like the musical aspects of, say, insects communicating in their natural habitat and interspersing that with human-created music to create a bit of a cooperative piece. It's taken on kind of a more experimental design based on or not there's an audience for the...
seeded my mind is that, you know, as you play the music, maybe the non-humans would then respond
to your
idea
as you and Kristen have...
Exactly.
No, I don't think I've heard of this before. I mean, it sounds great. I mean, I think the process of doing that.
Alan, do you know anybody that's done that already?
A lot of insights.
Yeah, I mean, I think there are specific examples, obviously with primates, where, you know, people have tried to establish communication channels with non-humans and try and get interaction going. But to approach this purely from an artistic point of view, you know, if there's any listener who's doing it, please contact us, because it turns out it's more difficult than we thought, right, Oscar?
Yes.
I think I have seen somebody who...
Yeah, and you know, there's a very famous artist in Southern California whose name just escaped me. How embarrassing. She was an artist residency that I hosted. She's an artist working with primatologists, and she started making movies where the intended audience was primates, not humans. And you know, she discovered very quickly that you can get monkeys to watch sex and violence of anybody, anytime. But they get kind of bored listening to certain other things that humans put in movies. and so, you know, actually, I should have you look her up, Oscar, because my short-term memory is not ringing up her name. But it turned out the scientists working with non-human primates have not experimented creating artworks for them to see what kind of art they get excited with.
That's kind of part of what we're doing.
Well, okay. Well, I'll retrieve her memory, her name from longer term memory. Alan, we're going to have to wrap up this first podcast. Okay, we've gone a little bit off track, but that's the idea. Mm-hmm. You want to get us back on track, and then the listeners may want to listen to the next podcast.
Yeah, I mean, like I mentioned before, I love going off on a tangent. I think this was great. I'd love to do another one if you wish, but I think this was really helpful and helped me think a little bit more about my dissertation.